Oh my, yes. Welcome to Nick Flanagan Weekly. I am Nick, and this is probably the 4,000th episode of Nick Flanagan Weekly, and thank you for joining me. It's roughly that. It feels like that. Anyway, this is 2024. We're here. We're somehow already 3 months in. I don't know what happened. I'm in another cat sit. That's why things take a long time with me. Plus, I've been doing more interviews. Editing them is not easy for me. And frankly, I've put some time in editing this one. And I hope the sound is good, because I'm a little concerned. So if the sound's a little bit peaky, I'm sorry. Peaky? Sorry. Today, I will be presenting to you a talk I had with Paul Perrier, a returning guest. He was on before. He visited my home in like 2018, my mother's home, but a home that I called my own as well. And that was a nice talk. And now he wrote a book, a memoir of sorts, called Cracked Wide Open, How My $45 Unplanned HBO. He gave it, I don't know, you know. It's called Cracked Wide Open, okay? Then it says, How My $45 Unplanned HBO Film About Addiction and Prostitution Shook Up Oprah Winfrey and Everyone Else Who Saw It. That's what it's called. But you can just look it up. I'll have the link in the show notes, and also you can order it on Amazon and look up Cracked Wide Open in Paul Perrier. You'll find a link to the book. There's lots of ways to do it. And you know what? You can get it very fast using Amazon Prime. Love advertising Amazon Prime. Get your Prime and then cancel it. You know that trick. Anyway, things have been, February was busy. I started a cat sit at one place. I did a second cat sit that I started now. So I've been outside of my home now for, I think, almost 2 weeks, just enjoying sumptuous living in different neighborhoods with wonderful cats. Today, it's Spunky for the next week, and Spunky's cool. He's very spunky. He's got spunk. People always go, oh, it's a funny name. You know, it's dirty name. And I say, no, I don't know what you're talking about. To have spunk is a beautiful thing. And Spunky has spunk. He also has diabetes, so go easy on him. Got to give him those diabetes injections. I probably talked about this in a past episode, because this is, I think, the second time I've taken care of him. And got to get up at 7, and then 12 hours later, got to give him another diabetes injection. And he has no idea it's happening, because he's busy feasting on his foods, as I did earlier. I went to Salvation Army over there on Bloor. Over there on Bloor Street. The Salvation Army. And I gave a phone that my own personal spunky, my lady friend, Sarah, had left at the apartment. And I took the time to shop while I was there. Just a small Salvation Army sample for you. Let's see what I picked up today. I love to tell you. I'll tell you, I posted about this on my Instagram. If you're not following me, it's at Nick Flanagan. I've also got a Nick Flanagan Weekly Instagram if you're interested in that. And if you're really interested in knowing about my findings, check out Optional Necessities, which is I made an Instagram for as well. Optional Necessities. And it's also the name of my eBay store. So you want to support the podcast and get something? Check out the eBay store. And message me, because I can probably work out a much better deal with you than what I've got going on eBay. Optional Necessities, my friend. But here's what I found at the Salvation Army. I found a copy of the Pulp Fiction soundtrack on CD. Not that exciting, I know. But I have a bunch of Quentin Tarantino soundtracks. And I'm probably going to start bundling my deals. And let me tell you, that Death Proof soundtrack is so good. You gotta listen to it. Throw it on when you're on a drive or doing something energetic, and or you wanna even dance around. There's some real hot tracks on there. Speaking of bundling, I got The music. Melrose Place, the music. Anyone remember Melrose Place? The nickname for the apartment building I live in is Smellrose Place. Don't worry about it. It's because it has all these people who know each other and get along. And then we thought, oh, let's make it a little self-deprecating. Smellrose Place. So I bought the music from Melrose Place. I can combine it with one of my Music from 90210 CDs. We got a bundle going. And I can get rid of this stuff. Weird to buy something so that you can get rid of it and another thing. It seems like you should just work on getting rid of the first thing without adding a second thing to also get rid of. But hey, I didn't invent bad logic. I just use it. Honestly, this Melrose Place, the music thing, very interesting. I hadn't looked at it before. You got Amy Mann starting it all off. Urge Overkill. 90s much? Sam Phillips? I think that that's like, he's like an old kind of soul singer, right? Sam Phillips? Famous. Change is going to come? Is that Sam Phillips? I think so. Wow. No, that's Sam Cooke. Sam Phillips. Anyway. Dinosaur Jr. 90s. Frente with an exclamation mark. Remember them? Their cover of Bizarre Love Triangle? That's not the song on it. Annie Lennox. The Divinals of I Touch Myself fame. Seed. Seed sounds like it's like that sort of like electronic industrial thing. Letters to Cleo. James and Paul Westerberg of The Replacements. That's a 90s soundtrack. Then I couldn't resist. I got a sealed copy of a young MC who made Bust a Move. Don't just stand there, bust a move. Do you want it, baby? You got it. You want it, baby? You just bust a move. So that he's got his famous Bust a Move album. It's called Stone Cold Ryman. I found out he's kind of British. I don't know if he's from England or born in England, moved to America. But yeah, I never knew Young MC was British until recently. So this is Young MC 1997. That's a whole entire universe of difference between the release of Bust a Move. I mean, the rap and dance sphere are very different at this point. So he puts out an album. And it's called Return of the One-Hit Wonder. So he knows what it's all about. And it's sealed, so I'm dubious about opening it. But I kind of want to give it a listen. You know, how can I not? I'm not yawning because I'm bored. I'm yawning because I'm me. Commandos 2, Men of Courage. I'm going to give you a little tip just to thank you for listening to the podcast. If you go to like a thrift store and you check out the CD section, sometimes you'll find computer games in there because they come in jewel cases that resemble CD cases. And you might pay a CD price rather than a game price, saving $2 to $3. So I got a game called Commandos 2, Men of Courage. I have no idea what it is. I have no way to play it. I just am stockpiling old computer games because I'm psychotic neurotic, which was the name of Diamond D's crew when he released his classic hip-hop album, Stunts, Blunts, and Hip-Hop. Thank you very much for listening to me give information to you. So, yeah, I don't know. Don't really have much to report. I'm kind of missing doing solo episodes. That's why I'm taking my time getting to the interview with Paul Perrier. But I have a lot I could probably talk about. I've watched a lot of movies. I think I was talking about Douglas Sirk in one of the episodes. Those are great movies. And probably going to see Dune 2 because I actually went to school in elementary school with the storyboard artist for the Denis Villeneuve films, including Dune 1 and 2. Sam Hudecki. So, you gotta support people. And, yeah. So, I don't know. I've seen a bunch of movies. I'm gonna throw on Tombstone. I have that on VHS with Val Kilmer at some point. Looking forward to that. Anyone seen Tombstone? What should I expect? Email me at weeklypodcast@gmail.com. weekly podcast@gmail.com. You know what that sound was? That sound was a gong, because I've actually joined this thing called Flow Club. I'm doing like a free trial. Again, I'm not paid to advertise this. I'm just telling you something. It happens to be something you could do. And it's actually like a workflow, shared workspace from home kind of concept where you can sort of set your goals, go into like a group, kind of a Zoom, although it's not on Zoom, and tell them what you're trying to do. Turn your sound off. Turn your camera off if you want. And see how far you can get in the goals while you're there. And I am liking it. I'll let you know if I continue to like it, continue to use it. But I'm liking it so far. So the gong signified that the chat I was in ended, which frankly means I haven't finished quite all my goals, because finishing up this podcast was one of them. And I'm still working on it, but I think it'll be out soon. So I'm feeling good about this goal. And tonight I'll be doing The Door for a concert at the Monarch Tavern for my friend Dan Burke, the concert promoter. It's an old school Toronto rock band called UIC. And I'm excited for it, partly because there's a pizza place I like near it. How and ever, I understand one of my goals in the next several months needs to be less sugar and carbs and bad stuff. That way I can be the best me I can be, rather than the most mid me. That's what the kids say, mid. They don't say basic anymore. They say mid. Okay. You want to know about some stand-up I'm doing soon? You don't? Well, you do, because I'm going to make you want to know about it by telling you this in a charismatic way about the shows. This Sunday, the 10th of March, 2:30 p.m., catch me and AL Sr. and Kurt Newman, who have both been on the show, both great musicians, and me doing comedy at the Transac in Toronto, 2:30 p.m. 14th, I'm back of March. I am back at the Transac on March 14th at 9:30, performing stand-up, alongside, again, Kurt Newman. Then, there might be more things coming, but all I know for sure is that in April, on April 11th, I'll be doing stand-up at the Transac with Kurt Newman, 9:30. Sunday the 13th, or Saturday the 13th, I'll be doing stand-up at Tall Boys, part of a great comedian, Rebecca Payne's show. It's 8 p.m., I believe. And the 14th, we're back at the Transac with AL and Kurt, 2:30 p.m., April 14th. Finally, I'll be at Capital Expresso. Capital Espresso in Parkdale on April 23rd, which is a Tuesday. And I'm not on this show, but if you're in Toronto and you want to check out a good comedy show, see Neil Hamburger, April 18th at Comedy Bar. He's doing a whole tour, so even if you're not in Toronto, check out where he's performing, and it might be your very town. Here is my chat with Paul Perrier. Enjoyed it. I hope you do too. How are you, Paul?
I'm good. Good to see you again, Nick. Been a while. I think the last time I saw you was, we did a podcast a couple of years ago, wasn't it?
I think it would have been 5 years, frankly, maybe four.
And what was it about? I think it was about one of my photography projects.
Yeah.
Was it during?
No, I think you came over.
Yeah, you came over.
So it wasn't during COVID.
Yeah, that's right. That was about photography.
I think it was more about your photography and a little bit about Cracked Not Broken. And we probably did something very similar to what just happened, where there was a 8-minute digression into books or movies or life.
Oh, are we rolling now?
Yeah, just the podcast.
I know.
Oh, that was sarcasm. I see you're fluent in sarcasm.
I am.
Do you know that shirt that says I'm fluent in sarcasm?
No.
What about the one that says sarcastic comment loading and it has like a loading symbol?
That one I know.
We can't all keep track of every shirt about sarcasm.
Yeah, there's tons.
Do you think I'm sarcastic?
I don't know you that well. I mean, I've known you for a while. I met you back in, I think, the early 2000s through Dan. And
definitely through Dan Burke, yeah.
Yeah, and then I saw you, through that, I saw you perform a few times, I think, with your band, and I saw you do stand-up comedy at the Alma Combo or the Silver Dollar or both.
Maybe the Drake Hotel, I don't know.
Yeah. And I photographed you a couple of times, and
we're not on a first name basis.
Yes, we are. or do I have to call you Mr. Flanagan?
Please call me. I'm actually a sir.
Okay. You didn't have the mustache last time I saw you.
No. I received a mustache. I was awarded a mustache at the end of COVID.
This isn't it's not a Movember thing.
No, it's not a leftover Movember thing. Although I kind of did grow it. I think it was like 2020. Basically, I had a beard. And at one point, I, of course, during the whole COVID period, like heavy COVID isolation period. And I was like, you know, I hate this beard. Why did I have a beard? This is silly. And then I said, well, now's my big chance to have a mustache. I've never had a mustache before. And now we're going on 3 years with it.
You look a bit like Austin Matthews.
Austin Matthews. Who's Austin Matthews again?
He's a sports figure.
Is he a racer?
Yep.
Ah, so I had heard of him. That's great. I'd love to be either heard of him or deduced that he had a British-y name and thought maybe that meant he was either a footballer or a racer. They love their racing.
I think he might play hockey too.
Oh, is he mostly a hockey player? Does he play for Montreal?
No, Toronto, I believe. Oh,
God, I'm so embarrassed. I should know that. There's a lot going on in the world.
I thought you were being facetious.
I don't know. I know. No. I'm out of the loop, man. I'm busy, unfortunately, you know, paying for parking and, you know, going to thrift stores and trying to sell things I find at places and things and getting them to people. And I'm doing comedy. My main job is not thrifting. It's just that I do it a lot more than anything else.
And you're still doing comedy?
Tons or enough. I want to do an album this year.
Where are you doing it?
I'm going to do it hopefully at the Monarch Tavern, actually, where our friend Dan Burke
performed. My band played the Monarch.
His booking. Oh, yeah. When did you do that?
We did it, I think, 3 days before COVID shut down.
Right.
And we were one of the last bands to play live in the city.
So during the COVID period, the lockdown, the heavy lockdown, did you write your book then? Is that when the genesis of writing your book happened?
No. So I've been trying to write a memoir for about 10 years. I think it did start 10 years ago. I started a Indiegogo campaign. Mm-hmm. I had written two pages of, I was going to call the book Point and Shoot, The Death of Photography. And it was about how I started taking photographs at the age of 12. Passion of mine. I studied it. I decided to pursue it. I grew up in Montreal. I moved to Toronto when I was 31 to pursue it here. And when the iPhone came out in 2007, that was a shift that affected my career as a photographer, because all of a sudden everybody could take great photographs, and all of a sudden, people weren't paying professionals anymore. So it really sent my career into a free fall. And it was sort of one of the reasons why I started making documentaries. And I took advantage of the revolution that was happening in filmmaking with digital technology. And I made my first film in 1999. I went to my high school reunion and made a film about it. And CBC screened it a year later. And that sort of led me, it was something I always wanted to do anyways. When I was a kid, I picked up my dad's Super 8 millimeter camera, and I started making movies, and I wanted to be like, I was going to a lot of movies in the 70s during my teen years, which was one of the greatest decades of filmmaking.
And that was in Montreal that you were doing this?
In Montreal. And this is what I want to do. I went to school, CEGEP, after high school, and started taking filmmaking courses, like filmmaking 101, photography 101, even though I had been fooling around with it, this was kind of more serious. And I was pretty good at it. And I decided that's what I was going to do. And I was going to go study filmmaking at Concordia University, but I didn't get into it for a weird reason, but it just sent me on a different track. And then I started studying photography, took photography very seriously, went to school for it, started in Montreal doing some freelance work. And then in 91, I decided, well, I'm going to go where most of the work has been done. I had a bit of difficulty speaking. I speak French, but I'm not bilingual. So being a photographer, if you can't speak the person's language that well, it's hard to make them comfortable. It's hard to make them comfortable anyways. But I just decided I'm going to come here. Here's where, you know, the competition is. Here's where most of the work is. And I came and I started doing it. And it's been a crazy, crazy ride.
Yeah, well, that's great. I think that's a really interesting summary of things. And also, you were, the iPhone was one thing. But I feel like even in the early 2000s, the advent of the digital camera was a pretty major change, right? I mean, that was probably even in the late 90s to mid 90s, I think. But still, you couldn't stage a photo quite as easily, I'm sure, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Digital photography, like that's when I knew that was when I started looking ahead a bit. Like I wasn't even, the iPhone wasn't even out there, but that was having a major effect on my business. Because when I started out, it was photography, it was film. You had to know about film. You had to know about processing. You had to know about printing. It was not anybody could pick up a camera.
You had to be happy hunching over with a little eye thing, you know, and looking at your prints and stuff.
Yeah, I've looked most of my life through a lens. So everybody's world is a 3D world, but I've spent a lot of time through a lens looking at the world, and it's a very different perspective than most people get. And I think I've done it even more than most photographers. It's been an interesting life. When I started, I didn't know, I don't know any photographers, or I didn't have I've had some mentors along the way, but I just went, I like doing it. I figured other people made a living doing it. I'll figure out how that works. And just kept doing it and kept doing it. And it was, as I say in the book, the door has been slammed on my face a million times. And that's part of being a commercial photographer or an artist. And you just, you either let it get to you. And, you know, when somebody says you're not good enough, you go, oh, okay, maybe you're right. But I always went, fuck, I'm good enough.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get better.
Do you still feel like you're trying to improve or improving at things you're pursuing as a person who is now, you were born in 1960.
When were you born? 60.
1960.
So January 1960.
You're officially an adult. The male does not fully mature until 64. So you're just legal now.
Well, with photography, like when digital photography came in the professional sense, I had to adjust. Like I had to make that adjustment from analog to digital. That was a learning process for sure. So I'm a good photographer. I think I'm a great photographer.
I love your photos.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
I love your photos of myself, and I love that mask series. And
yeah,
I have reason to be proud of what you do.
I'm totally proud of what I do. And if you don't get good at something after you've done it for 50 years, and you know, I don't know what that says, but it's like a musician. It's like a stand-up. Good point.
Sex is one of the few that you sort of like just. It's kind of like eye color,
right? But it's like it's anything. It's not just the arts. Yeah. It's you get better, you get more confident, you get more comfortable. It's still very uncomfortable. Where I was going with that too is when you get really good at something, I find it sometimes gets boring. So that's why I've expanded. Like I started making movies, like because that's was the original thing I wanted to do. I started playing music 10 years ago or 15 years ago because I'd been photographing bands for years, and I was just going, fuck, I want to do that. I want to be on stage. And I was photographing comedians like for years, for laughs. And well, I mean, my interest in comedy goes back to the 70s too, when I was watching The Tonight Show and then Letterman. And I studied them. I'd stay up at night and watch them. And I was a pretty funny kid. I worked on my humor by studying it, and it was a bit of a defense mechanism for me. But I decided at one point in the 80s that I was going to try it. I was going to go do an open mic night I was in Montreal at the time, and I write about this in the book. I was going to do it in Montreal, but my parents were a little embarrassed that maybe a friend of theirs would see me bomb, and they were kind of embarrassed. So I decided to go to Ottawa because there was a Yuck Yucks there. My brother was actually studying law at Ottawa U, and I figured, well, nobody will know me. I can bomb. I knew I was going to bomb, but I just wanted to try it. So I wrote 5 minutes of I don't know what it was, and I went to Yuck Yucks on a Tuesday evening. It was open mic night, and in Ottawa, 1985. It was a February night, and I signed my name up, go to the club, and the host that night was Norm MacDonald. He was just at the beginning of his career. So he was hosting open mic night, and he did 15 minutes of comedy that was so brilliant.
You're preaching to the converted here. So during the COVID period, the lockdown, the heavy lockdown, did you write your book. Then did that when the genesis of writing your book happened?
No. So I've been trying to write a memoir for about 10 years. I think it did start 10 years ago. I started a Indiegogo campaign. Mm-hmm. I had written two pages of, I was going to call the book Point and Shoot, The Death of Photography. And it was about how I started taking photographs at the age of 12. It was a passion of mine. I studied it. I decided to pursue it. I grew up in Montreal. I moved to Toronto when I was 31 to pursue it here. And when the iPhone came out in 2007, that was a shift that affected my career as a photographer, because all of a sudden everybody could take great photographs, and all of a sudden people weren't paying professionals anymore. So it really sent my career into a free fall, and it was sort of one of the reasons why I started making documentaries. And I took advantage of the revolution that was happening in filmmaking with digital technology. And I made my first film in 1999. I went to my high school reunion and made a film about it. And mm-hmm. CBC screened it a year later. And that sort of led me. It was something I always wanted to do anyways. When I was a kid, I picked up my dad's Super 8 millimeter camera, and I started making movies, and I wanted to be like, I was going to a lot of movies in the 70s during my teen years, which was one of the greatest decades of filmmaking.
And that was in Montreal that you were doing this?
In Montreal. And this is what I want to do. I went to school, CEGEP, after high school, and started taking filmmaking courses, like filmmaking 101, photography 101. Even though I had been fooling around with it, this was kind of more serious. And I was pretty good at it, and I decided that's what I was going to do. And I was going to go study filmmaking at Concordia University, but I didn't get into it for a weird reason, but it just sent me on a different track. And then I started studying photography, took photography very seriously, went to school for it, started in Montreal doing some freelance work, And then in 91, I decided, well, I'm going to go where most of the work is being done. I had a bit of difficulty speaking. I speak French, but I'm not bilingual. So being a photographer, if you can't speak the person's language that well, it's hard to make them comfortable. It's hard to make them comfortable anyways. But I just decided I'm going to come here. Here's where, you know, the competition is. Here's where most of the work is. And I came and I started doing it. And it's been a crazy, crazy ride.
Yeah, well, that's great. I think that's a really interesting summary of things. And also, you were, the iPhone was one thing. But I feel like even in the early 2000s, the advent of the digital camera was a pretty major change, right? I mean, that was probably even in the late 90s to mid 90s, I think. But still, you couldn't stage a photo quite as easily, I'm sure, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Digital photography, like that's when I knew that was when I started looking ahead a bit. Like I wasn't even, the iPhone wasn't even out there, but that was having a major effect on my business. Because when I started out, it was photography. It was film. You had to know about film. You had to know about processing. You had to know about printing. Yeah. It was a very, not anybody could pick up a camera.
You had to be happy hunching over with a little eye thing, you know, and looking at your prints and stuff.
Yeah, I've looked most of my life through a lens. So this everybody's world is a 3D world, but I've spent a lot of time through a lens looking at the world, and it's a very different perspective than most people get. And I think I've done it even more than most photographers. It's been an interesting life. When I started, I don't know any photographers, or I didn't have I've had some mentors along the way, but I just went, I like doing it. I figured other people made a living doing it. I'll figure out how that works. And just kept doing it and kept doing it. And it was, as I say in the book, the door has been slammed on my face a million times. And that's part of being a commercial photographer or an artist. And you either let it get to you. And, when somebody says you're not good enough, you go, okay, maybe you're right. But I always went, fuck, I'm good enough.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get better.
Do you still feel like you're trying to improve or improving at things you're pursuing as a person who is now, you were born in 1960.
When were you born? 60. 60.
1960.
So January 1960.
You're officially an adult. The male does not fully mature until 64. So you're just legal now. So you still feel like that urge to improve and the urge to learn more. I know that's like a leading question. Like, I'm not trying to get it.
No,
I'm not. I pretty much know what's going on. But, I am interested in that, or to the extent that you're doing that or how you're pursuing that.
Well, with photography, like when digital photography came in the professional sense, I had to adjust. Like, I had to make that adjustment from analog to digital. That was a learning process for sure. I'm a good photographer. I think I'm a great photographer.
I love your photos.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
I love your photos of myself, and I love that mask series. And
listen,
to be proud of what you do.
I'm totally proud of what I do. And if you don't get good at something after you've done it for 50 years, then I don't know what that says, but it's like a musician. It's like a stand-up. Good point.
Sex is one of the few that you sort of like, just, it's kind of like eye color.
Right. But it's like, it's anything. It's not just the arts. Yeah. It's you get better, you get more confident, you get more comfortable. It's still very uncomfortable. Where I was going with that too is when you get really good at something, I find it sometimes gets boring. So that's why I've expanded. Like I started making movies, that was the original thing I wanted to do. I started playing music 10 years ago or 15 years ago, because I'd been photographing bands for years, and I was just going, fuck, I want to do that. I want to be on stage. And I was photographing comedians like for years, for laughs. And my interest in comedy goes back to the 70s too, when I was watching The Tonight Show and then Letterman. And I studied them. I'd stay up at night and watch them. And I was a pretty funny kid. I worked on my humor by studying it, and it was a bit of a defense mechanism for me. But I decided at one point in the 80s that I was going to try it. I was going to go to...
Go on.
Well, I was going to go do an open mic night. I was in Montreal at the time, and I write about this in the book. I was going to do it in Montreal, but my parents were a little embarrassed that maybe a friend of theirs would see me bomb, and they were kind of embarrassed. So I decided to go to Ottawa because there was a Yuck Yucks there. My brother was actually studying law at Ottawa U, and I figured, well, nobody will know me. I can bomb. I knew I was going to bomb, but I just wanted to try it. So I wrote 5 minutes of, I don't know what it was. And I went to Yuck Yucks on a Tuesday evening. It was open mic night. And
in Ottawa.
Read it in Ottawa, 1985. It was a February night. And I signed my name up, go to the club. And the host that night was Norm MacDonald. He was just at the beginning of his career. So he was hosting open mic night. And he did 15 minutes of comedy that was so brilliant.
Preaching to the converted here.
Yeah. Well, he became one of the best stand-up comics ever.
Might be my favorite.
I sat there and went, fuck, I can't follow this. And I walked out of the club and I'm not kidding. Norm MacDonald
inspired you to not do comedy.
Yeah, and sent me back on the path to being a photographer. And after that, I started shooting stand-up comedians, portraits. I've got a really good portfolio of stand-up comedians that I've shot portraits of and live. I've seen everybody. I've shot Kinison, I've shot Bill Hicks, I've shot Jim Carrey, I've seen them all. And then that led me to writing a book. Because I've always just been interested in the arts, and I figured if I can get good at being a photographer, I can get good at other stuff. And it keeps me, art keeps me kind of sane in a way, although you have to be insane to do it, mm-hmm. to pursue it, and you really do.
Slightly, yeah, or majorly.
Yeah.
You know, it's
somewhere in the spectrum.
You know, it's amazing to me the amount of people that have managed to have families and homes and stuff to art, because you know, it's not that easy. Although I kind of think that being like, it all stems from like whatever you're doing, being an iconoclast, being a eccentric, as some might call it, being a collector, not you, but just these types of things, these sort of devotions, they tend to lend themselves to difficulty because,
totally.
You know, it's about passion to some extent, but it's also about a forced myopia, you know, where you're just like, this is the stuff I'm doing, this is what I'm going to do. And then it's also about appreciation of, you know, we're all fueled by, no matter what we're doing, we're fueled by the world and very often, if not the art currently around us, the art that inspired us or the movements that, you know, started it all or formative learning, like for things like visual art or photography. But I mean, I know like antique dealer types who have that, you know, type of a soul, even if they're not doing it. And it's very, all very lateral, I feel. Like,
yep.
You know, like the gun dealer in Taxi Driver guy who Martin Scorsese made a little mini documentary about when he was making Taxi Driver. He wasn't a gun dealer, but he was like a, in real life, but he was a, an eccentric guy.
Yep.
Very, and you know, he could have been in the arts easily, but I don't think he was generally. I think he did some
right.
stuff, but you know, so yeah, anyway, I'm going on a major tangent, but yes, but, art keeps us sane, whether, you know, yeah, whatever we deem it, you know,
listen,
in expressing ourselves keeps us sane.
It is a, it has been a struggle and continues to be a struggle, but I look at it and I look at most of the people I know where everybody's struggling. This is a tough time and you struggle with life at the best of times, like life is or ups and downs and everybody goes through it. So I just decided I'm going to struggle and do what I want to do.
Yeah, I think that that's definitely a moment that I had at some point, you know. I don't know, you know. It's like sometimes you don't do it or don't feel like you're on the ball with the doing it enough, and then you kind of go, well, is this, if I'm not doing it, then what am I leading this life for, you know?
Right. But, and it's healthy to walk away from stuff too for a while.
Yeah, that's something I learned from all this too, is just that, you know, when you do pursue it, when you do say, well, this is what I'm going to do, it's like, well, I moved back here in Toronto. Oh, from my visa running out, and it's not like I was moving to a small place, vibrant place.
You went to LA.
Yeah, and there's communities and arts and industry here, but I like being here because it's like my mom's still alive, so I get, which is great. Congrats to her. And she's not that old. So, but, you know, so I get to see my mom and help out my mom, like, and then my sister's here. So we get to hang out and, you know, like I found somebody here. So as well. And so it's like, those aspects, you know, to help maybe temper the difficulty of all of this.
Yeah.
You know, it are good. And for me, borderline, they're like becoming not a the priority, but I'm kind of like, you know, where there is an artistic overload going on, or at least a creative output overload, because the word art might not be. I don't know. It's pretty complicated. Like, I think skill is right now valued highly. You know, people love learning from the internet. They love learning from how to photograph things, how to get them sounding the best, how to get them doing the best, how to rap the fastest, how to sing in the best key. But sometimes it's like the ideas are sort of like secondary, you know, like a lot of the most popular things right now on YouTube are people reacting to things, or people telling the story of you, other YouTubers, or commenting on other YouTubers,
right.
And that's fine. You know that, and they're making money, but it's like, is that anywhere near art? Is that anywhere near media? Okay, if it is, that's fine. But like, what is it? What is anything? You know, so I'm kind of thrown off by all of that right now, yeah. Because I don't totally distinguish myself from that world. I just, with what I'm doing, I mean, your book was, you know, self-published, which is great, and is essentially at this point probably the most prevalent form of book that is published.
Well, because I also
of the nature of that, you know, if I'm not incorrect.
Yeah.
I saw on the Amazon thing it said self-published, so I'm not saying that to shame at all. You know,
no, listen.
Yeah.
No, I pitched this to a bunch of people publishers. And of course, it was refused by all of them. And then I did what I've always done is, I mean, it is self-published, but I actually found someone who was going to support me through it. I didn't do all this book all on my own. I had editors, I had proofreaders, I had somebody who laid it out. And it came out, you know, as good as I think I could do. So I published this. Oh, back to publishers.
Yeah.
I looked into what happens when an author gets a publisher too. And that is a very tricky, I know some people who have been published with decent sized publishing houses, and it's they control you. They'll control most parts of it. And what happened with my book was I got to control it as much as possible. And I own 100% of it now. And I believe it, my book has some value to it, much like my film did. The core to my story here, and the reason I wrote this book, and it's still my memoir, I still tell that story about my life, how I became a photographer and a filmmaker. But what really spurred this one on is a year ago, I found an envelope full of responses of people who had seen my film at various stages from the...
And you're talking about Cracked, Not Broken?
Cracked, Not Broken. That's why my book's called Cracked Wide Open. Mm-hmm. And I screened it at the Regent Theater, which is a block from me here still.
Where's the Regent? It's not
Mount Pleasant, just north of Davisville.
I just drove past it yesterday. God, that area, if you're visiting Toronto and you are like, where are all the old film marquees? They're around Mount Pleasant in Eglinton. So go up there.
And the Mount Pleasant is being refurbished. It's been closed since COVID. They're turning it into they're refurbishing the theater and turning it into a really beautiful spot. And yeah, that's, so anyways, that's where I first screened the film in September of 2005. I think 100 people came out. I don't know if you were at that screening.
No, I don't think I came out. I probably had no idea how to get there. And
PTC.
Sounds hard. But I did watch it. Like, you would send me cuts of the film. You actually gave me a DVD of it. That's how I remember, around then or before.
Okay, so I have a question for you because you're actually in my book because
you mentioned it.
You were the first person to review my film for a publication. In the book, I put it as Now Magazine, but we were talking that you were actually working for I Magazine at the time.
What do you say when you watch a movie and it goes, some of the events have been kind of like folded together for the ease of the thing, you know?
Right.
And even in documentaries, like we watch, I watched The Fake Shake with, which is a British documentary about a tabloid journalist. That's what it said at the beginning. And so it was interviewing people, but it was also saying, some of these characters have been so it wasn't a factual thing, you know, it was a documentary.
Right. The same thing with my book too. Like I time shift a couple of things. I remembered it as Now Magazine anyways, but it didn't occur to me till we talked. But it doesn't make
two free
difference.
Weeklies in Toronto that are now basically defunct. Basically, there is a new magazine, but I don't know, it's its own thing.
Yeah, no, when Now and I Weekly came out as physical copies, those were like, I picked those up every week because that's how you found
them up
you found out where the cool music was happening, where the comedy.
So it was the way of knowing what was going on in the city, you know, it was a very different thing. You know, than we have now. maybe neither better nor worse in terms of, you know, there are people who've grown up and they're finding out about shows because I'm working a lot of things locally, like through Instagrams of, you know, specific promoters and this kind of thing. But yeah, it's very different. But yes, I think that's probably why I didn't go. Is that what you were going to say? Is like I had to review it before it came out, possibly before this what happened.
Well, as I'm thinking about it, so I screen it. Because it wasn't just I at that point. There was a team that was building up, and after that screening, the film took on a life of its own. Which 9 months later, we were on Oprah Winfrey. So that's how crazy it got. But the third screening we did, so after that, we started doing school screenings because somebody who was at the first screening asked us to screen it for parents and kids. And that was amazing. And then we did a screening at the Drake Underground. And I think you were, that's where you reviewed it. So were you there?
Oh, okay. So I did watch it there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I definitely had a DVD of it and may still have a DVD of it, but
I hope so.
I hope so. Yeah. And
the signed and limited edition, my book, and they have a valid reason. They don't need a valid reason at all. If they just say, I want my money back, I'm going to give them their money back. Like I stand behind my
use proof of purchase.
You need
proof of purchase.
Yeah. But so that's the end of my book, the rules and regulations for the money back guarantee. And one thing I say is you need proof of purchase and also write out a little critique why you didn't like it. So my next book will be better because there's another part of this book, like a lot of the reaction to my film was very, very positive, right? Like, there was this person who was using her struggle to change people's lives and literally save people's lives. But there was, when it got out there to like, my film was on Hulu and HBO and like HBO bought my film for their addiction series. Some of the response people sent me about my work and my filmmaking is like, and I publish it all, like, because I found it fascinating. Like, at least as an artist, you want people to respond to your work, whether it's good or bad, because the bad will help, the good will help, but somewhere in between, you know, is the normal. But it's the, you know, it's the people who don't react that bother me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's true. It's the people who don't react are often also the ones who aren't even really engaging. Not engaging with your work is the most painful thing, basically.
For the artist.
For the artist. It feels great for the person. One less thing to engage with. It's the idea of being unseen and unheard, you know, is a really tough pill, to swallow for someone who makes something. And it's, for the majority, it's often the case, you know, and that's, I think one of the things I'd like to get past as a performer and a person putting stuff out there is, you know, accepting those who enjoy or even give an ear to, no matter big or small, and being grateful for it and saying, well, I still made the thing and then it's going to exist. So who knows? Maybe someone's going to notice it in the future, you know? So I think that that's a really important way of staying sane as you get older and, you kind of have peaks and valleys of, notoriety or being noticed or some other n-word, not that n-word, but some other
n-word.
You know, it's
the fame word,
the fame word, near fame adjacent, you know. And
listen, fame, I don't
NFT,
know,
that was the n-word I was thinking.
I've had brushes with fame. Like when your work gets out, like some of my work has gotten out, and there's that aspect to it. But that is, fame and success hold their own, you know, troubles.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Also,
it changes everything.
Fame has a lot more problems than success does.
Yeah,
I think fame is the one where it's like people assume you're making money. They assume you're having a next thing, and it's like the truth, especially if you're putting things out, is that the thing that people is making people think, the thing that people watched or listened to that is making them think that you've got all this stuff going on, it came out last year. And this year, you haven't made anything.
Yeah.
Or it came out this year and you didn't work that, like it comes out a year. It's been done for months, year maybe. And you haven't done anything since then. You know, it's like sometimes that's the case. And then, you know, that's definitely one of the things, is people sort of presuming, you know, right, like infinite funds and stuff. Or funds or resources or work, more than funds, like just, well, you're a working artist. And it's like, well, I was working, and you're seeing the example of it, but not everybody is always working, you know?
Yeah. And listen, writing this book and making making a record or a documentary is hard enough on its own, but then the real hard part is getting people to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And like, you gotta be, hopefully be good at what you're putting out there, but then you gotta learn to be good at promoting it. And promoting it has been a bit of a tough one for me, because I think people think I'm a very outgoing person, but I'm a very shy person. And getting up on stage at Yuck Yucks, and especially reading my book, like I actually told some jokes that went well. And I actually last night riffed and did some freestyle stuff that worked. But when I read my book, my voice starts to quiver. And what I put out there is, I mean, it was tough, because that film affected a lot of people, and some people are still very sensitive about it. I waited, you know, the film was made 20 years ago, and I took 10 years to write this, and I did it as consciously as possible. But when you're writing about addiction and divorce and death and all these other happy subjects about life, people are going to get upset at, you know, or uncomfortable. Like I wrote in my book, I write about the last picture I took of my dad, and I publish, it's in the book, and I write about that moment. And the picture, my mother's still alive, she's 94 years old, and I was really worried about what my mom, when she got to that point in the book, would think, because I could have published a really, my dad was a great looking guy when he was younger, and I have great pictures of him, but this photograph, that he was suffering from Alzheimer's at the time and was in a home. And my mom said, if you want to see your dad again, you got to come home. So I went back and I ended up in this hospital room with them. And it was one of those, I get emotional thinking about it now, but I did take a picture of him. Like, we couldn't really communicate, he wasn't talking at that point,
right?
And as I take this picture and I look at it afterwards, I go, I think maybe my dad, when I pulled out that camera, might have known who I was for a second. Like, there's something about that picture that there's at least a glimpse of my old dad. And I just spoke, my mother just finished the book yesterday, and she called me, and you know, we talked about all that, and she loved it. and bald. And but she goes, yeah, I understand why. She goes, obviously, I would have loved another picture, but I understand why you had to put that picture in.
Yeah, the Alzheimer's. That sucks. Alzheimer's is a rough one.
Yeah. Yep. Oddly, it was when I got closest to my dad.
Yeah. That happens with, I think, illness a lot of the time, you know.
Yeah, for sure. But,
similar. I mean, I don't know. I always sort of had something with my dad, a closeness. But, when he got sick, that was, it was a rallying point both for the family and for our relationship, I guess. But, the truth is a long-term illness of almost any kind that's terminal, or you want to call it, especially when you get to those last points, it's very, really heavy.
Really heavy. Yep.
So your book is going to talk a bit about this kind of high point of Oprah and your movie taking on somewhat of a life of its own, your movie about addiction, one person's addiction and their potential road to recovery and their spirit. And this, you go on Oprah, it doesn't produce, in the long run, it doesn't produce the effects you necessarily expected, put it that way. And you said your life becomes a lot more complicated and chaotic after that. Is that true?
That's 100% true. The Oprah appearance, which I talk about, that's a major part of my book and a major shift in my life for sure.
Is she a real person? Is she made of a plastic or is she human?
I can't really answer that. I never met her.
Yeah.
Other than I was sitting in the front row of the Oprah Winfrey show and mic'd up because there was a chance she was going to ask me a question. But what ended up happening was we go to Chicago to be on the show, and I think it's going to be good. I think it's going to be good for everybody in a sense. What happens, and I'm, I can't say this 100% sure, but, looking at the interview, which I've done many times, it's clear that Oprah had not seen the movie. So, so that you could tell, like, I thought it was going to be a woman who's in trouble and this icon who had experienced drugs in her youth too, would come together and tell this great story about what Lisa was trying to do with her story and inspire people and get herself clean. But the interview was insane. It was just somebody had written her questions, and it was didn't really have to do with what we were talking about. And Lisa was great on it. She handled it well, but it was just stupid. And it could have been great, and it could have been something else. So after that, that sort of changed Lisa's perspective. Like that, I know how tough that was. Like there's, we were talking about anonymity before.
See?
It is hard. It's hard. But I think
you say it fast.
That's right. There you go. I think, when this started, I don't think anybody really believed my film would go that far, other than maybe a couple of screenings in Toronto. But it took, like, it went around the world that it was getting covered by everybody. And then after Oprah, even though that was a bit of a disaster, and but it was still a good thing too. It still got the message out there. HBO took on the film for their addiction series because the executive producer was watching Oprah that day and said, I have to have this film. And it was one of four independent films to be included in the addiction series. And, you know, the addiction series was made by all Academy Award winning documentary filmmakers. And, my work was running beside it. And I was like, fuck, you never know.
You never know. But being out there and being broadcasted out there is always a bit helpful.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. That's the thing.
This is helpful.
Thank you. This is helpful. You doing?
Well, listen, it's that's what I mean, I had approached other people, not before you, I'd reached out to you too, but I reached out to some other podcasts and stuff, and I've been turned down by them, and that's fine. But I have a plan to do a podcast tour coming up. This one is the first one, and I want to lead up to my version of Oprah Winfrey, which is Joe Rogan, and
Jopra. Someone's already called him that, I'm sure.
Really? But I think it would be fascinating, because what happened with my film and where it got to, it was two women talking with each other about this. And in my book's case, it would be two men. And Joe Rogan is a stand-up comedian. So we have a lot of that. You know, we can talk comedy, we can talk drugs, we can talk whatever. I think
talk about cancel culture or politics.
I don't think I'll talk about politics. Well, not that I would.
I'm only saying that because he does that on every episode. From what
right.
I can see. He probably doesn't do it on every episode. He does it. Fair
enough. I listen to Rogan. I listen to Mark Maron. I listen to Orny Adams. They're all those.
Tell me about Orny Adams's podcast.
I think it's called What's Wrong with Orny Adams. You know him? You know of him?
I know who he is. I mean, I watched Comedian when it came out, obviously, and he's been doing comedy for years now. You know, he's still doing it. He's still active. So, you know.
Right. So
I'm aware of Orny Adams.
I met Orny in 2002. At Just for Laughs. And the reason I was at Just for Laughs is I was pitching this stand-up comedy film documentary I had about using my story about when I walked away from stand-up comedy because of Norm Macdonald to my photography of stand-up comedians to finally doing stand-up comedy. That was going to be the end of the film. Me doing stand-up comedy once. I pitched it to Just for Laughs that that's where I would do it, and that would be the end of the film. So Bruce Hills, who's the COO of Just for Laughs and a friend from Montreal, said, well, why don't you come shoot a bit and put something together and see if maybe we can do something. So I went. I must have been like you at the Drake Underground. I'm in the hotel. And I'm just going up and meet any comedian I saw. I had my portfolio of portraits of comedians, and I'd ask them to pose for a photograph and let me interview them. And Orny Adams was one of the first guys I asked. And he, at that time, told me that he goes, oh, I'm going to be in a documentary myself. Called Comedian. It was coming out the next month. So we had that little thing together. And then when Comedian came out, like I think Comedian's is one of the best documentaries about stand-up that I've seen. Mm-hmm. But what they did to Orny, it was fascinating. Like his career, I think he thought this is my big break, right? But they kind of made him look like they made him look terrible.
They made him look terrible. I mean, you know, yeah. It's a great example of Seinfeld's lack of mercy as a human being. At times, you know, he's one of these guys, you know, and this, you see this a lot with comedians and probably with the famous people in general, where like, I don't know, you'll hear a story or you'll see them be like amazing with someone, you know, and then you'll see them completely ice out like 70% of other people or something. Or in this case, it was a little more painful and a little worse, because if you think about it, it's obviously Seinfeld was, I don't know if he directed it, but I'm sure he had lots of power over that film's presentation. And he is basically presenting himself as the antithesis of Orny Adams, who is, it's almost like Seinfeld's born to do it, or Orny isn't, but he's trying. That's like almost what the presentation is, if I'm talking about it in an unbiased, without assuming malice on anybody's on anyone's part in the film, like is they presented it like Orny wasn't someone, he was someone who had to work hard to even try to be funny, and was erotic about that. If I recall. It's been a while since I've seen.
And so he, like myself, like you, there are consequences, like when you put yourself out there. So that was it. I think we would have a really fascinating conversation about that period of time. And we were both, you know, young. Well, I wasn't as young. He's younger than I am, but I was still at that point in my career where I was going, I'm going to do this. And at the same festival, I met Marc Maron. And photographed him in my hotel room. And he wasn't Marc Maron that he is now. He was, I don't know where he was on his career, but I had never heard of him. And now he has, you know, one of the biggest podcasts. And we actually, as I've listened to his podcast, we've actually had one other encounter that I write a bit about in my book that I wasn't aware of till now that I think would be a fascinating conversation. But I just think there's something about stand-up comedy and what I've done and what the people I've met and photographed that I hope these come together and can help my book get out there, because I think
stand-up comes up in the book as a theme a lot.
Yeah. Mark Breslin wrote the blurb for the back of the book. Comedies. I want it to be a comedian at one point. Mm-hmm. And I still, my book, which is like we're talking about dark subjects, I write it with quite a sense of humor.
Yeah.
So yeah,
that's, you know, yeah. You got it. What are you going to do? Write it dryly about your own life experience? I mean, come on. You got to be funny. You got to have a laugh.
Yeah, but it's not easy being funny. Like, I'm not a writer. That's why it took me 10 years
to write. People who call themselves writers who take 10 years to write.
I mean, yeah. Well, listen, it's
yourself. You don't feel like a natural writer. You're the Orny Adams of writing a book.
Right. Well, I've spent my whole life telling stories visually. So writing, I didn't do much writing, although I write every day. I've been writing every day for a long time, but that's just it's for my mental health. And I believe this book was for my mental health. What happened with my story is it reaches this pinnacle. And I think I've made it all these years of struggling. And now I've got this, a potential audience in front of me of millions. And I think, you know, now I can control my career, and my life fell apart for like, it was like falling off Everest. And this book, so the film stops. I'm kind of, like you say, I have to reinvent myself again and go back to trying to get photography going or trying to do whatever. And then a year ago, it reminds me of this book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, where he says it takes 10 years to get 10 years of practice or 10,000 hours to get good at something. And I definitely spent that time on writing, and then it clicked. And it took me a year to write around all these reviews. But when I read it now, it's like, I can't believe I wrote this.
Yeah. That's a good feeling.
Yeah. It's amazing. I'm proud of this book. It's one of the, I don't know when I'm going to die, but this will live on, and I'm happy with that. I'm okay with it.
Hey, hopefully you don't die.
Well, my mother's 94, so I think I'm in pretty good. I'm 64, and I'm in pretty decent shape. So if I can keep going like that, and hopefully a bus doesn't hit me.
No buses.
No buses.
No buses. Stay away from buses.
I mean, the other thing I want to do besides the podcast tour, which is short term, like I hope all this happens in the next few months, is next summer I want to do a cross Canada bike book tour and promote it that way.
Like a motorcycle or a regular
bicycle? No. Bicycle.
Just biking everywhere.
Biking and doing across Canada, and I'd shoot another portrait series that expand on the Toronto portrait series and make it a cross Canada portrait series of Canadians, and hopefully raise money for either mental health issues or homelessness and
Alzheimer's research.
Maybe.
I mean, you know, that would be a little self-serving though, JK. The older we get, you know, the aging population. Let me tell you, Alzheimer's research is not going to go down in funding. You know what I'm saying? It's probably the number one worry of all kinds.
Yeah. And I think coming back to that, when you have a dad who has Alzheimer's, that I wanted to finish my book before my memory went.
Yeah.
In case that happens.
Just in case. Yeah, no, I think that's great. That's really a big thing, is just sort of chronicling, you know, our lives and, you know, our own lives and the things that have touched us and the situations that we've ricocheted from. And it's, I think it's a good thing to do, you know. And I'm impressed that you managed to do, you know, 10 years. Yes, maybe it took 10 years, but remaining devoted to writing it over the course of 10 years is its own thing. You know, its own achievement.
And when I speak to people now, I say, like, I think everybody should start writing a memoir. Not necessarily to be published, but just for yourself, because it's hard. It was really hard, but it is fascinating how you can tie what seem like random events in your life and meeting random people at certain points in your life who come in and come out of your life, and you tie it all together and you go, well, that got me exactly to where I am today. And that's exactly why I'm the person I am today. And it's really fascinating. Like, I kind of wish my dad had written. My dad lived a pretty fascinating. He was a chartered accountant, but he lived. I write about it in the book. He was like the James Bond of chartered accountants, and I learned more about his career after he died, But I wish my dad had written about his life.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe you just have to keep piecing it together and then write out his life for him.
Well, you know, it isn't. His life is in my book, and it deeply affected my life, as any parental child relationship does.
True. True dad. okay. Paul.
Yeah.
How can people get a copy of your physical only copy?
Amazon.
Published book. So you go on Amazon, type in Paul Perrier, Cracked Wide Open.
Cracked Wide Open. Yeah. And you order it and it'll be at your house 3 days later. And if you do, and you want me to sign it, I'll come over and sign it. Or
and also put it on Goodreads, folks. Add it to your want to read list and all that good stuff. And
yeah, listen.
I can't wait to get my physical copy.
Yeah, I can't wait for you to read it.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, the way people can help me is buy my book and either review it. There's a few reviews up there now, three good, one bad. But that's okay. Like, I don't care if they're good or bad, just review it and
yeah,
talk about it and give it as a gift and give it to people who you think might need it. Because I believe the book is, it's not just a fluff piece and it's not just, oh Paul Perrier. There's important information from other people in my book.
Yeah. And where can people find Crack Not Broken, the film that sort of kickstarted some of the content in the book?
I think it's still available for rent on Apple TV. I think that's the only place. Or if you have the CD, a DVD.
And the, DVD, I can make a copy. Upload
yeah. And you can make millions.
I'd love to make millions. Success over fame.
Yeah, man.
Paul, thanks so much.
Hold on, Nick.
Yeah.
One photo.
Okay.
Thanks so much for listening to that podcast I did with Paul. That interview for the podcast. Paul Perrier, check out his book. Cracked Wide Open, etc., etc. It's got a long title. The link is in the show notes, and also you can find it by Googling Paul Perrier and Cracked Wide Open, or looking on DuckDuckGo for it, or Bing, or whatever your search engine of choice. Hopefully it's an electric engine and not a gas engine. A little environmental humor for you. Yeah, so thanks so much for listening. I'll be back soon. I'm going to keep on plugging, trying to sort out some interviews and stuff. I like getting returning guests, but I'm going to try to get some new ones too. It's a process, my friends. It's a process. And I really hope you're doing well and that things are moving along. And even though things are stressful, they're actually not that bad. And I have faith that we will overcome the many challenges we have and live to ripe old ages, sitting on porches, reading books, looking at animals. Thanks to Paul for coming over or for Zooming with me and chatting. And thank you. And if you want to help out the podcast, you can go to ko-fi.com/Nick Flanagan. And leave a donation, or you can also go to the eBay store I was telling you about, Optional Necessities. Check out all the stuff on it. I have like over 500 things listed. And message me, and we can maybe sort it out without eBay. Unless you want to just buy it on eBay, but does anybody win that way? You tell me. Write me at weeklypodcast@gmail.com. weeklypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much. Flanagan. Weekly. Nick Flanagan.